We're on page 309 in John T. Christian's The History of the Baptist. As the Baptists went into wilderness, they went into these wilderness so they could have freedom of religion and so they could preach. And we're going to run into some of this as we go there. A lot of Indian trouble. Now, you can't blame the Indians too much because they had taken over the East Coast part of the country. And as they're coming into what we call the Midwest now, Missouri and Mississippi and Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, as you're coming into these areas, they're seeing they're going to come in and take over our place again and just run us off, which they had done otherwise. And so they're fighting for their freedom and for their land. And the Baptists are trying to find some place where they can worship God without being arrested, killed, shot, burned, dunked in rivers until they were drowned. He said, this settlement was made in perilous time. The Indians made every exertion to cut them off and prevent their settlements. They tried many stratagems to decoy them ashore in their passage down the river. After they settled, they were continually lurking to destroy them. And they were obliged to, for a number of years, to live mostly in forts and blockhouses. And notwithstanding all the precautions, a number of their first settlers fell victims to the rage of their savage neighbors. Now, in 1787, James Smith, a Baptist minister whose name is found in the first table of Kentucky, made them a visit. And he preached the gospel with good effect. A few families in their settlement had been in the habit of keeping the Sabbath, governing their children, and holding meeting for religious purposes. At that period, there was none who had been members of churches. Their method of observing the Sabbath was to meet, sing hymns, and one would read a chapter of the Scripture or a sermon from some other author. No public prayer was made until after the visit of Smith. And some had professed to be converted at that time. And James Smith visited the settlements of Illinois three times. The Indians made frequent depredations against them. On one occasion, they captured Smith and conveyed him prisoner to one of their towns in Wabash. Now, I want you to understand something about these Indians. These are Cherokees, and these are the civilized tribes. And why they call them civilized tribes is because they had great plantations and homes and cities and towns. They didn't live in villages like teepees. And these people had homes. The people of Illinois, though extremely poor, raised a ransom of $170. In January 1794, Josiah Dodge, originally from the Connecticut, but one of the pioneers of Kentucky, visited Illinois in February, baptized four converts. One of those baptized by James Lehman Sr., who had become a preacher, and left four sons who were preachers. No church was organized on this occasion. In the spring of 1796, David Bagley, removed his family from Virginia to this territory and preached among people for several weeks, baptizing 15 persons with the aid of Joseph Chance, organized the New Design Baptist Church. Of 28 members, the work prospered, and shortly afterwards in 1798, two men organized another church of 15 members in the American Bottom. Now, you have to realize they had to build churches here. Some people would drive a day to get to church. And when they got to church a whole day, they wanted to camp out and eat and to hear preaching all day. And so they had to put churches in like every 10, 15 miles because this is a long time. They didn't have Studebakers and Cadillacs. They had horses and buggies and foot. Of 28 members of the New Design Baptist Church, the work prospered, and shortly afterwards, in 1798, two men organized another church, 15 members, in the American Bottom. The churches in Illinois soon became sadly divided on the subject of slavery and other causes. The Baptists of Illinois lived a genuinely pioneer life. You wouldn't know that today. Illinois is pretty well populated. Many a family, says one of those associated with these heroes of the faith, long after the New Design was settled, was exterminated, tomahawked, and scalped by the Indians. The cougar, the coyote, the bear, the Indian had to be met in those days by one class of men, while another class turned the sod and tilled the soil and reaped the grain, and still another had to plant and build and sustain the churches. All of these onerous duties were often performed by one and the same class of people. The man went to the place of a workshop clad in a suit of dressed buckskins, with moccasins on his feet, a shot pouch swung at his side, and the ever-present rifle on his shoulder, and preached the gospel to few neighbors and gathered inside the log cabin while others were stationed outside as watches and scouts and pickets. In this company of pioneers, J.M. Peck was a mighty man, born in Litchfield, Connecticut in 1789, a descendant of one of those by whom the New England colonies were planted. With imperfect advantages of the early education, reared in a Congregationalist, but becoming a Baptist through independent study of the New Testament, ordained at Catskill, New York in 1813, after a brief pastorate in Armenia, in that state he removed to 1816 to Philadelphia, where he studied theology under Dr. Stoughton, and having later caught the missionary spirit from Luther Rice. Remember Luther Rice now, Adoniah Judson and Luther Rice. He devoted his life thenceforth to missionary services in the West. Now we're talking about home missions, not foreign missions, but home missions. But in all reality, this may as well have been foreign country. His home was in the first in St. Louis and in St. Charles, Missouri. But after some years, he fixed it finally at Rock Spring, Illinois. From this time on, he became a principal figure in Illinois Baptist Society until his death in 1858. He was, says Sprague, undoubtedly one of the most remarkable self-made men of the day. He was among Baptists in home mission work in the West, what Judson was there in foreign work. After a long and tiresome trip, he reached St. Louis, which was, for a time was the base of his operations. In this new country, he had assumed a most discouraging task, and his journal sets forth the extreme difficulties which he encountered. The people, he said, throughout these extreme frontier settlements were quite ignorant. Few could read and write, and fewer families had Bibles. Why do you need a Bible if you can't read or write? The only reason why Baptists had Bibles if you couldn't read or write is to write down when you got married, when a man and a woman concealed themselves to each other, and then every child that they had. And these Bibles were legal records. Mm-hmm. But many of the families that even had a Bible could not read them. The people throughout this frontier settlements were quite ignorant, and few could read and write. They knew not the name of a single missionary on earth, and could not comprehend the reasons why money should be raised for the expenses, and why ministers should leave their neighborhoods to preach the gospel to the destitute in other places. Remember, we got a lot of hard-shell Baptists here, too. Hard-shell Baptists are extreme Calvinists, and they don't believe you need to send a missionary, because if there's a guy out there going to be saved, God, in his irresistible grace, is going to draw him to church, theologically. They manifested the same apathy in their worldly business, a small cornfield and a truck patch were the height of their ambition. Venison, bear meat, and hog meat dressed and cooked in the most slovenly and filthy manner, with cornbread baked in the form of pone and when cold, as hard as a bricket, constituted their provisions, meager lives. Coffee and tea were prohibited articles amongst this class. They didn't have any coffee and tea. That's luxury. For had they possessed these articles, not one woman in ten knew how to cook them. Didn't know how to make coffee or tea. Not a school had existed. A kind of half-savage life appeared to be their choice. Doubtless, in a few years, when the land became into market, this class of squatters cleared out for the frontier range in Arkansas. They just kept going from one frontier, like Abraham Lincoln's father. He said, if you can see the smoke of the neighbor's chimney, you're too close. Start moving. He said, the first thing is to select the right place in some hollow or ravine. Now, he's going to spend the night out in the open wilderness from the wind, and if possible, behind some old forest giant which the storms of the winter have prostrated, fallen down. And when the reader don't build your fire against the tree, for this is the place for your head and shoulders to lie, and around which the smoke and the heated air curl. And don't be so childish as to lie on the wet ground and frozen earth without a bed. Even Bigfoot make beds when they lie down.
Yeah, so do pigs.
Now, maybe you don't believe that, but that's a fact. Gather a quantity of grass, leaves, and small brush, and after you have cleared away the snow and provided the protection from the wet, cold earth, you may sleep comfortably. If you have a piece of jerked venison and a bit of pone and a cup of water, you may make out a splendid supper, provided you think so, as a man thinketh, so is he. If you had jerked meat, venison, I have some venison jerky right here. You can take that venison jerky, and it's really dried, and mine is really dry, like powder, almost like a potato chip. If you take that and put some vegetable or something with it, or even just some cornmeal, and boil it in a pot for a while, you got a cereal with meat in it. He was never a great speaker, but he was a great organizer. He saw in the new country the need of schools. On a visit to the Bethel Association of Missouri, he put into operation a plan of society which worked wonders. When he called on by the association to speak upon the subject of missions, he presented a copy of the annual report of the board, and then enlarged at length upon the value of missionary work and the opportunities which were opening for large and successful undertakings by the denomination. This is Baptist now. Foreign missions were inland here. He also suggested that the association, through its corresponding secretary, enter into a correspondence with the Board of Foreign Missions. He then outlined the plan to propose society to embrace all Baptist churches in Missouri and Illinois, which should desire to affiliate with them. And he submitted for discussion a carefully prepared constitution. According to its provisions, the objects of the new society were to be twofold: to aid the Western mission, that's Illinois, that's Ohio, that's Missouri, that's Tennessee, that's Arkansas, Kentucky. These were wildernesses. In spreading of the gospel and providing common schools in the western part of the America, both among the whites and the Indians, educate the Indians also. It's awful hard for a Baptist to go behind a Catholic that has enslaved the Indians and filled them with superstition more than what they even had before. And you go in there and try to tell them the truth. You may get hit in the head with a tomahawk. A person of good moral character could become a member on payment of an annual fee of $5. Each Baptist association contributing to the work could send two missionaries to the annual meeting. These are what you call, this is delegates. They had this in the book of Acts. And one of the matters particularly emphasized was the consideration of means whereby prospective school teachers and ministers could be aided in obtaining an education. Many times, ministers became school teachers because they were the ones who could read and write, if they could read and write, okay? And so it was to, first of all, to educate the ministry, and then ministry could educate the people in these villages. It was not the purpose of the founders to use any of the funds of the society to pay salaries of teachers amongst white settlers. This was done by the local communities. But the society was to aid worthy young people to prepare for the ministry and for a profession. And it was also to be on the lookout constantly for good teachers to import them from the East. Now today we wouldn't want to export or import teachers from the East because they're too liberal. Now the East was the conservatives at this time. If it deemed advisable to introduce them to the schools, in other words, it was to combine in this department of activity the functions of teachers' recruiting station and board of education and teaching agency and Sunday schools. That was a foreign thing, remember. Now, Sunday schools weren't looked upon as good. They were looked upon as, in the North, they already had Sunday schools to get the kids out of the factories, to educate them, to learn, teach them how to read and write. But here, very few people knew how to read and write, and these Sunday schools were newfangled ideas. In spite of the opposition of the two visiting preachers from the Boone's Lick country, who were anti-mission and anti-everything, the Bethel Association voted heartily to endorse the plan embodied in the Constitution which had been submitted. It was formally adopted that the Illinois Association on October the 10th and by the Missouri Association October the 24th, following its adoption by the later body, the organization of the society was completed and under vigorous leadership of Mr. Peck, this is James Peck. It began operation almost immediately. It was the first society of any denomination to be organized west of the Mississippi for philanthropic purposes. It is natural for ardent natures to dream dreams. It is easy and fascinating to form plans and to translate them into constitutions and bylaws. The new society was a vision and an ambition. What was it? What really was it? Was it anything more than that? To do this, you have to get people to cooperate. And that wasn't quite so easy. You can put down all the laws and all the best plans of mice and men, but you've got to get people to cooperate. The provisions already outlined, for instance, with regard to the oversight of the teachers, the improvement of educational facilities, sound, impressive, rather statesmanlike, but were they workable? Distances were great. Facilities for travel were a minimum. The churches were poor and widely scattered. The preachers were ignorant. The sentiment against schools and education was strong. Remember, these people believe God's supposed to pour the message in your head when you got up in the pulpit. More like the Pentecostals and the charismatic group today. The people were occupied with the immediate task of clearing the land and making a livelihood, and all the conditions of life were primitive. Immorality was prevalent. Religious indifference was almost universal. How was the strong and positive influence of the new educational system to be made effective? Immorality. You know what the immorality was? The greatest part of the immorality is not observing the Sunday Sabbath. Now, we did have Seventh-day Sabbaths. Seventh-day Adventists. I'm not Adventist, but Seventh-day Baptist. But if you didn't observe, if you worked on Sunday, you were considered immorality, horrible, gross immorality. You should be home either going to church or teaching your kids on Sunday. It is difficult to say just how it was done, but that it was really accomplished as shown by the facts. Within 3 years after the formation of the new society, more than 50 schools were established in Missouri and Illinois. They were common nuisances with drunken and illiterate Irish Catholics at their head had before existed. This seems startling, but inconceivable, yet the fact stands. Out of the movement comes Shirtliff College. About the year 1800, the immense stretch of the country from the Ohio to the Great Lakes and thence to Missouri was known as the Northwest Territory. Now you think of the Northwest Territory as up in Washington and Oregon, up in that area. But here, the Northwest Territory was this country that was looking like, this is the pioneer, this is the wilderness. It was divided into the 7 counties. Wayne County included the whole of Michigan. Knox County, the most of the Indians and part of Illinois. Most of Indiana, that is, and part of Illinois. When the settlers in the wilderness began to clear small patches of ground around William McCoy of Shelby County, Kentucky, and made frequent visits to Indiana and preached the gospel with good results, he was the father of Isaac McCoy, who became the apostle to the Indians in this section. As a result of these visits, he organized a church about the year 1798. Now we're vacillating back in the 1800s, just back and forth. We're talking about different people. It said there had been some dispute about the regard of this church, for it appears to have been at times likewise called Owens Creek, Knox County. He had a son, Isaac McCoy, who was associated with George Waller of Kentucky. Together, they explored the wilderness of Indiana Territory, of Indian Territory, as far as the Visinese, preaching wherever they could gather a few persons in cabins or in the woods. Through their instrumentally, a church was organized 8 miles north of Vicinos in 1806. And the same year, a church was called Bethel, further down the Wabash. These were followed by organization of Petoke, Salem, Moriah, and Pigeon Creek churches. Now remember, there was a Pigeon Trail back then. My great-great-grandfather, Smith Paul, ran away from home because his father married a woman and she wanted him dead. She tried to get him hung for horse thief. Anyway, took off. And he took off down the Pigeon Trail. And back in then, these wild pigeons, they would roost in these trees, and they could just reach up there with a stick and knock some of them down, and you could cook them and eat them. There were so many. Well, using them for targets, this is where we have the clay pigeons, except they weren't clay pigeons at one time. They were real pigeons. They caught these pigeons, they'd turn them loose, and people would shoot them by the thousands. And they would come and shoot them by the thousands until they were all gone. The carrier pigeon is no more. But this was the Pigeon Trail. The 6 churches with 6 ministers, Alexander Devins, James Martin, Isaac McCoy, Stephen Strickland, were formed into an association called Wabash. It met in the Bethel Meeting House in Knox County, and the sermon was preached by George Waller. The churches number 133 communicants. This was 3 years before the organization of the Silver Creek Association, whose churches were planted earlier. The remoteness of the Wabash from other associations doubtless hastened the organization. In other words, they wanted churches to organize together and get in associations like they did in the Bible, in the book of Acts, to encourage each other doctrinally sound. That's one of the things Baptists have always had tried to preach, doctrinal soundness. And they were trying to get the churches to be what was the Bible taught and why you believe it. And the Silver Creek Association was formed in 1812 from churches mostly dismissed from the Long Run Association in Kentucky. These associations were followed by others in this section. In the southwestern portion of the state, a few Baptists settled in 1809. George Hume from Campbellsburg, Kentucky, made repeated visits to the Langri, a stream empties into the Great Miami, a few miles below Cincinnati. Remember that name. His labors were blessed, and in 1811 a revival followed in which a great number were baptized. Thus, at Longdrew Church were formed and built the first house of worship, costing $300. This was the first church house in this whole district. Association was soon formed. Association was formed of several churches in that area. Some of the churches only met in caves and homes. The two foremost men were John Watts and Jesse Holman. Watts was a man of great gifts, but gave up the ministry to become a United States Senator. Holman was born near Danville, Kentucky, and he became the Supreme Court judge of the state and afterwards a federal judge. He did not give up the ministry and was a tower of strength for the Baptist cause. The following is a story of the removal of Judge Holman to Indiana and was published after his death, and will give some idea of the sacrifices. Now, this is quite a story of these early settlers. I sent my household furniture, a very small stock, by water. And by water means by boat, to reach Verdestin before my arrival. The weather had been remarkably fine for several days, and on Monday evening, when we crossed the river into Indiana, there seemed to be a fair prospect of its continuous, but about the time we started on Tuesday morning, it commenced snowing. It commenced snowing, and the snow continued to fall all day. My wife's health was still delicate. Her babe was 2 months old, and yet we persevered in our journey. In fact, there was but little prospect of doing better, as there were few families living on the road and not much promise of accommodation by them. They would go from family to farm, and they would stay in there and sleep in their beds, and they would feed them. This is hospitality. This is what we call country or pioneer hospitality. When he reached our cabin, we were cold, we were hungry, we were fatigued, and what a prospect we presented. The eye of the civilized woman scarcely ever looked upon a more lonely, dreary, desolate habitation. The man who had in charge of my furniture had not arrived. No mark of human feet, no, nor the feet of any animal, had disturbed the smooth surface of the snow around their cabin. All of this, as uniform and as unbroken as if no living thing had ever been there, or had long since departed. The inside of the hut was chilling and cheerless as the prospect was outside. The snow had drifted through the crevices in the roof and down upon the open chimney and covered the floor, and some places were as deep as it was without, outside. There was no fire. It was more than a mile down the river hill to the nearest dwelling, and the night was setting in. It gets cold at night, doesn't it, Marilyn? We live in a wilderness, don't we? And there were myself, my weary wife, sinking with exhaustion, chilled and shivering with cold, our sweet, tender infant. It was no time for thought, but for action. Not that we didn't think in such emergencies, but thoughts rush in so rapidly in succession that scarcely a moment is employed in thinking. You act. I had a small feather bed and some blankets, which I had used while preparing my habitation. I scraped the snow from part of the floor, and there lay a bed, and folded my wife and my baby into the blankets, then laid them on the bed and wrapped it over them, and cheered and encouraged the dear woman with the assurance that she should have all the comforts it was in my power to give to her. I gave her lips and the heart all the warmth of my kisses, could impart, and then secured my horses and sought the nearest habitation. He secured the horses out of the weather. There are very few men who could outrun me when I would put forth my utmost speed. and never had I such a motive for such a speed before in my life. I had run when I thought the Indian's tomahawk was just behind me. I had run from the fangs of the surly bear and the ferocious wolf, but I never before ran to prevent my wife and my child from perishing with cold. Seldom, if ever, was such a distance traversed by man in such a short time. The strides I made in descending the hill and afterwards to be seen in the snow, they were prodigious, but I could have run no further. I instantly dispatched two men, inspired with something of the energy with which I was nerved. I had to pause to breathe for a few minutes myself, but my wife and my child were too dear to me to let me linger while I was able to move. I returned, however, much slower than I came. My two neighbors, with great zeal and diligence, for which I shall always feel gratitude and grateful, had built up a large blazing fire and swept the snow from the floor. This is neighbors now. This is what neighbors do back then. This is pioneer neighbors. And my wife, with bright countenance, was soon seated before the fire, and one of the few stools which were at my only seats, our neighbors having rendered all the assistance we needed, returned home. I had a coffee pot and some teacups. Now, these were luxuries, people. That's a judge now. This is the big shot. But his furniture didn't make it there. He's going to go out in this country. He's going to preach the gospel. In which he made and drank our tea, not the most palatable to refined tea drinkers, but we were thankful for it. After which I read the chapter in the Bible, and we, for the first time in our lives, knelt down together and gave thanks to God for the mercies we had enjoyed, and committed ourselves to His paternal care. And there is not much of this world's goods that we are absolutely necessary to happiness. And we had laid down that night on our very humble couch with feelings as cheerful as we had ever been enjoyed, when surrounded with all the comforts of our luxuries and in the splendors of life. So it was with me, so that I believe it was with my wife. She was far less accustomed to privations than I was. But she always said, I believe she said truly, that she could be happy with me in any situation. You've said that many times, haven't you, Marilyn? You could be happy with me in any situation. But she was now, and for a long time, but severely to the absolute hardest tests. Our furniture did not arrive. We looked for a day after day, but it came not. We were suffering for want of it, and our neighbors were too few, too far distant, and too destitute themselves to lend us any, and there was none to be purchased. I borrowed a single chair and one or two trifling articles, and with these we lived for about a week. I was compelled to go out and several times among the neighbors in order to procure the means of subsistence, food, and we had few nearer than 3 or 4 miles apart. 3 or 4 miles in the snow is a long way. Yeah. I remember this winter when I was walking out there in 5 and 6 foot of snow. For me to get out there 100 yards to one of the storage containers was, and out there in between the storage containers was a tractor. And I had to get on that tractor and see if it would run and see if I could get it to go through all this snow before we could get in and out of our yard. That was a task. And it was only 50 yards. On these occasions, Betsy was left alone with the infant in a solitary wild where no human beings were to be seen, and she knew not where to be found in case she needed assistance and protection. Transported at once from a populous region swarming with inhabitants, from the border of a highway, along the stream of passengers was incessantly flowing, to an unpeopled wilderness which the retiring savages had recently given up to the wild beast and few backwoods Americans. Her imagination had full room for dreary pictures and dark apprehensions. Everything tended to involve gloom and foreboding. My presence ensured protection to her. My smile lightened her solitary scenery. But in my absence, all was startling loneliness and fear. This is quite a story, isn't it?
Yes.
Quite a story. This is what our forefathers, this is how they brought the gospel to the wild, wild west. You know, when I was about 5 years old, I went back to visit my family in Oklahoma. And I watched a little bit of TV at neighbors' houses, listened to radio programs and things. And when I was going to go back to Oklahoma and Texas, I was thinking I was going to the Wild West, and I was living in the Wild West, in all reality. And every time I saw a Texaco station, I thought it was Texas. I thought we were there. And when I got there, I was so surprised. We had more horses in California than they did in Texas and places. They were cities. Still, down my little street where I lived there on Citrus Avenue, every morning and every afternoon, there was a buckboard coming down with a horse-pulled buckboard with a guy saying, "Iceman, Iceman, Iceman." Right behind me was a stable where they rented out horses, a livery stable called Ragsdale's Riding Academy. And I was one of the bronc busters out there that kept the bronc going the right direction. I realized I was in the Wild West already. And we're going to get in later on where the church, when the Baptists came to California, the Northern Baptists and the Catholics had made a compact that they were never going to send a Baptist out in California, and here these Southern Baptists came, these Southern Orthodox missionary Baptists. And when they went to church, they went to church with a gun. Because the Catholics were going to break up their organization here right away. Well, these are the things that our people died for and lived for and suffered for in deprivation, in wilderness, so they could preach the gospel. Our Father, we send this message out that you might honor and glorify it throughout the world. Make people appreciate what they have today and what we need to hold on to, too, in this time and age that we live in. Father, please forgive me where I fail you. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.